You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. There are few parenting decisions that evoke more controversy and even vitriol than whether and how long to breastfeed. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 80% of American babies start out breastfed. But 1 in 6 breastfed babies get some formula supplementation in the first days of life. And by 6 months of age, only 1/4 of babies are exclusively breastfed. 3/4 are getting their nutrition from some combination of breast milk, formula, other milk, and foods. And my next guest says that kind of all-of-the-above approach to feeding babies is not necessarily anything new. In fact, it could date back 5,000 years to early agricultural communities in Europe. Julie Dunn is a postdoctoral researcher in archaeology at the University of Bristol, and she recently published evidence of clay baby bottles from archaeological sites in Germany. Julie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Nice to talk to you.
So what do these baby bottles look like? Because I'm guessing they look very little like modern day baby bottles.
Well, actually, Heather, surprisingly enough, they almost do look a little bit like modern day baby bottles, in as much as that the shape is, the basic shape is a little bowl, so almost like a sippy cup. But they do vary tremendously. I mean, they're quite small, about 5 to 10 centimetres across.
So a couple of inches across.
Yeah, so 2 to 3 inches. Yeah, some are a little bit bigger, more like 4 to 5 inches. And as I say, they all seem to be quite different. So some are very, very plain, just a little bowl with a spout. But others take the most amazing form of these lovely little mythical animals, sometimes with 2 feet and sometimes with 4. People say they look like kangaroos or ducks or all sorts of things. They are very, very cute. I can't recommend highly enough that your listeners go and look at them, because they're the most lovely little things. And but the most common feature, is that they all have a spout through which milk could be suckled.
And how far back do these potential baby bottles date?
Well, the oldest ones that we know of actually go back 7,000 years. So that's to the Neolithic in Central Europe. Yeah, that's pretty old, isn't it? Yeah.
And how old does clay pottery as a whole go back?
Well, that's interesting. So in Europe, or, well, in, let's say, in the Near East, so that's where the European pottery comes from, that goes back to about 8,000 to 10,000 years. But the earliest pottery that we know of is in Japan, and that's called the Jomon culture. And those people were actually hunter-gatherers who lived by the coast, and their pottery goes back to about 15,000 to 18,000 years ago. So it's pretty old.
But in these European areas where you found what appear to be baby bottles, it seems like they were pretty early in the evolution of pottery as a whole.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So around about 5,000 BC, so 7,000 years ago. So that is quite early, because that's sort of the time that pottery would have reached Central Europe, which is the region we were looking at.
And there's been some debate as to what these sippy cups, bottles, were actually used for, whether they were actually for babies or whether they were maybe for adults who were sick, or maybe for the elderly at a point in their life when they couldn't feed themselves and eat solid foods. How did you actually figure out that these are most likely baby bottles?
Yeah, so that was always a slight sort of controversy, that we couldn't be sure they were baby bottles, because it may have been that they were used to feed sick people. So what we actually did was we set out to look for baby bottles in children's graves, because we reasoned that if they're found in child graves, then they must belong to the children that have been buried. And that's not easy, because although we know there are quite a lot of these little vessels, there's about 100, 150 across Central Europe. But not that many of them were found in child graves. They're very often found as stray finds on settlements, archaeological sites. So it was finding them in children's graves that was important for the project.
And then, Julie Dunn, the most recent bit of evidence to support the idea that these are baby bottles are that you actually found evidence of cow milk or sheep or goat milk having been what was in these cups. How do you figure that out thousands of years later?
Yes, so fascinating. We use an amazing technique which is called organic residue analysis. And what we do is we actually extract something called compounds called lipids. So these are the fats, oils and waxes of the natural world. Humans, animals, we all have lipids in us. And we can actually extract these from the ceramic matrix of a pot and using a combination of molecular and isotopic analysis, we can determine what foods were processed in these pots. And we were very pleased to find that actually, as you say, it was ruminant milk. So that's either cows, sheep or goats. We can't tell the difference because, of course, their physiology is all the same.
Do you have to destroy these precious little baby bottles in order to do that analysis?
Yes, I'm afraid no museum curator is going to let you do that. So what happens is normally what we do in the technique is, yes, we do take bits, just old pot sherds, and they're very, very common on archaeological sites. And we actually grind them up to a powder and we do destroy them. But of course, in this case, these things are so precious that we couldn't do that. So we had to adopt a modified sampling strategy. And what we actually did was took the vessel. And luckily, the ones we'd found were quite open shapes. So we cleaned off a little bit of the surface of the inside with a modelling drill just to remove any contamination, because, of course, they've been handled quite a lot over the years. And then once we'd removed the contamination, I just actually drilled out the powder very, very slowly. It took about an hour to do. And that sort of is releasing the lipids at the same time. And I gathered all the powder together till we had just about under a gram's worth of ceramic powder to analyse. I must tell you, it was pretty nerve-wracking because although I was so careful, the thought that, you know, they might break or something is quite terrifying. So, yeah, it was tough, but worth it.
Well, Julie Dunn, your work is looking at specifically these potential baby bottles, figuring out that they held milk and that they likely are baby bottles. How does that fit with other evidence we have about how babies and children were being fed at that point in time?
Well, that's the astonishing thing, really, is there was no other evidence for how babies were fed. We literally knew nothing about how babies or you know, small young infants were fed. There was no information on that whatsoever. The only thing we did know was the general age at which weaning occurred. And the reason we were able to look at that is we can look at the nitrogen isotopes in infants' bones and teeth. And that told us that in that area, Central Europe, in around about that time, babies were weaned between the age of 6 months to 2 to 3 years.
That's quite a range.
Yes, that is quite a range, yes. But that's all we knew. We didn't know any more than that. We didn't know what they were fed on.
So this might suggest that they were supplementing breastfeeding with milk, or do we have any way of knowing how this actually fit into the overall scheme of feeding babies and small children?
Yeah, we don't really know. I mean, I think what we tend to think that it's probably a mixture of supplementing and then sort of and or weaning. Because obviously we do know nowadays that it's around about 6 months that a mother's breast milk doesn't contain all the nutrients that a child needs. So it's at that time that you have to start supplementing anyway. So we assume that they are probably supplementing from then and through weaning. Or they may be supplementing earlier, though. We don't know. I mean, it could be that the vessels were used in cases where perhaps if the mother had died, the baby might have been fed animal milk, you know, from quite early on. But we just don't know that at all, really.
And we talked about the fact that these baby bottles, in terms of the timeline of making ceramics, show up pretty early. But how does the timing of these baby bottles showing up compare to the timing of when ruminant milk, when, you know, cows, sheep, goat milk would have actually been available to people as these communities were becoming more agricultural?
Yeah, so this is where actually the baby bottles really do fit into this big picture, because it's around about 8,000-9,000 BC in the Near East that we humans, we stop being hunter-gatherers and we settle down, start living a more agricultural lifestyle. So we do domesticate animals, cows, sheep, goats and pigs, and we start growing cereal crops, of course. So as this happens, this means that at this point, these foods then become available, milk and cereals become available to wean babies onto. So they weren't available to, say, the hunter-gatherer women. And what we know is that hunter-gatherer women have quite long interbirth intervals, so they have babies about every 5 years. But once people start living this settled farming type lifestyle, we know that women have babies much more often, much more quickly, so about every 2 years. And that's because it's literally because these new foods are available, milk and cereals. And what that means is that all of a sudden we get essentially a baby boom. It's called, in technical terms, the Neolithic demographic transition. And we see this really big population explosion. And of course, what that means then is bigger groups of people, they have to start expanding out to get more land. So they expand out across Europe, eventually ending up in the UK several thousand years later, about 4000 BC. But they're in Central Europe around about this time, 5,000 to 6,000 BC. But what's fascinating about that is what we've gone from is we've gone from baby bottles, milk to feed babies, right through to large settlements. We see the rise of cities, and that really does all put us on the path to urbanization, the way we live today.
And Julie Dunn, you wrote a piece about this research for theconversation.com in which you actually say, this one sentence really jumped out at me, by holding these ancient baby bottles, we're connected to the first generations of children who grew up in the transition from hunter-gatherer groups to communities based around agriculture. I mean, you already mentioned, of course, it's nerve-wracking to hold these and drill into them because just they're so precious, they're so rare. But it sounds like you've got a real, I don't know, emotional, almost spiritual connection to what these baby bottles mean and what it means to be able to hold one of these.
Yeah, I mean, yes, absolutely. It was a real privilege to work with them. And, you know, you look at them and I mean, all archaeologists want is, you know, what we're interested in is how people lived in the past. And to get such a very real and immediate and personal connection is you know, quite unusual. I feel very lucky to have worked on them. They're such lovely, evocative little objects. And you can just imagine, you know, the mothers giving them to their babies, and the ones that are sort of funny, you can see the children laughing as they take them and hold them. And for me, I think, you know, one of the nicest things is it really does show the sort of creativity of these people and the playfulness. And I think it really shows the love and the care that they had for their children. These women are exactly the same as mothers today.
Julie Dunn is a postdoctoral researcher in archaeology at the University of Bristol. She and colleagues recently published evidence that clay baby bottles from archaeological sites in Germany held milk. Julie, thanks for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Heather.
Up next, an allergy researcher and father of a child with a peanut allergy talks about the promise of immune therapies. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Scientists are people. There's no getting around that. There are protocols and systems to make sure personal beliefs don't unduly influence scientific results. But sometimes personal and professional lives collide or overlap in important ways, and that's not always bad. Here's one example. Edwin Kim is an allergy researcher. He leads the Food Allergy Initiative at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's working to develop therapies for peanut allergies. As luck would have it, he also has a young son with a peanut allergy, and he recently wrote about how those parts of his life are intertwined in a piece for theconversation.com. Edwin, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What first got you professionally interested in food allergies and peanut allergies specifically? I mean, this interest and your research predates having a child with an allergy.
That's right. So really, the interest actually started way back when I was younger, and my younger brother actually grew up with allergic diseases, including asthma and milk allergy, which he quickly outgrew. But it was something that had stuck out in my mind of, you know, what was actually happening to him. It kind of got buried in the back of my mind, and then it didn't really pop back out until I was actually in medical school when I happened to be doing a rotation at the Duke University Medical Center, where I had met Wesley Burks, And Wesley Burks is a world-renowned food allergist. And that's where I really started to understand how something as simple as food that should be, you know, just this benign thing that we have social events around could actually cause these scary anaphylactic reactions in people.
Hmm. Well, Edwin Kim, you were studying and working on peanut allergy therapies. You had a young son, and you maybe had an inside track on kind of the leading edge of what would the best advice be. So what was that first time that your son had peanut butter like?
Well, so being the allergist and being the one studying peanut allergy, I was very well aware of what we were doing, introducing peanut. We actually had a bottle of Benadryl sitting on the side, hopefully trying to ward off evil spirits. And we gave him a little bit of peanut butter on a piece of toast. And, you know, almost immediately he started turning red all around his mouth. And again, I knew exactly what it was, although, of course, I was in denial. And so I tried to just, you know, get him cleaned up and got him some Benadryl. It happened to be right there, and just waited and watched. And it was a surreal moment because it's something that I had been doing not only in clinic, but in research almost on a daily basis. And then to suddenly see it at our own dining room table in the house was just, again, something that I don't know that I fully could accept at the moment. Unfortunately, then the reaction continued to progress, where then he ended up having a head-to-toe rash, what we call hives, as well as then vomited a few times, and then ultimately had breathing problems where he was repeatedly coughing. And so really sort of the whole gambit of symptoms that we're constantly telling our patients to look out for, he kind of had all in one reaction. And then, of course, ultimately we ended up going to see the doctor, and he got epinephrine in an injection. And sure enough, like all the other patients, everything went away magically. But again, for those couple of hours of just watching that whole thing unfold was something that just it sticks out in my mind even to this day.
Yeah, a dose of empathy and maybe motivation for your work.
Oh, absolutely.
So Edwin Kim, you are involved in work trying to develop therapies for peanut allergies, ways to actually for people who have a severe peanut allergy, the idea being to gradually introduce a tiny bit of peanut into their systems until their immune system can learn to not overreact to that. And there's one option that's currently available that's based on peanut flour. How does that therapy work, and how much evidence do we have that it does work?
Yeah, so the concept actually is very similar to what a lot of people may be familiar with in allergy shots, where we give small amounts of the actual sort of outdoor allergens or pollens in order to desensitize or make patients less reactive and have less symptoms. But what we found for food was trying to do it in an injection form just had so many side effects that it just wasn't something that we could reliably do. And so really, investigators like Dr. Burks, who I'd mentioned earlier, decided that perhaps maybe eating it, so in an oral form, since that's the way food is normally taken, could take advantage of some of the aspects of the immune system to be able to have the same idea, the same concept of small increasing amounts of what you're allergic to actually work. And so conveniently, after I mentioned that I had met Dr. Burks early in my career, and I happened to be able to fall into his lab, and I've been working with him really ever since 2008. And so we were part of these early studies of again, small increasing amounts of peanut flour that, if done in the right way, I see it as being enough that your immune system can see it, but not so much that you have an outward reaction. And you just slowly step that up to get them to a point where they're regularly eating peanut but not having any outward symptoms.
Wow. And so does that mean that the allergy is essentially gone? Does it cure the allergy or just make it something that is less threatening to people with a peanut allergy?
Yeah. So at this moment, it doesn't seem to be a cure. And we still need to do more work to understand what the long-term sort of benefits of this are. But everything seems to be pointing towards not a cure. But at the same time, it does seem to be very effective in trying to make a patient less reactive. So if that person who's eating this peanut treatment were to go to a restaurant and not realize that there was peanut in that meal that they had had, whereas in the past that might have caused a reaction or even a severe reaction, in this case, hopefully making them not reactive at all.
At least in the case of a child like your own, being able to sit at the same table with another kid who's eating a peanut butter sandwich without worrying that that could be life-threatening.
Yes, I mean, that would be wonderful. And a story I'll quickly tell is I went to lunch with my son on the very first day. And for probably the few weeks, if not month before, all I kept training him on was to not share food and just eat what we sent him. So what happens on the very first day of school? All the kids are sharing their food. And so that, you know, that kind of concept, because, you know, I do, you know, you do what you can to try to control your environment, but it's not perfect. You just can't control everything as much as you'd like to. And so something like these treatments hopefully can just sort of protect against those experiences that, again, may be outside of what you can control.
Well, Edwin Kim, you mentioned treatments. There's the peanut flour that is taken orally. There's also now a peanut patch. How effective is that compared to actually eating a peanut product as a therapy?
Yeah, so the peanut patch is exciting in that it is so, so simple to do. It really is literally a sticker that you just put on the kid's back. And in that way, it's actually seeping a little bit of peanut into the skin to the immune system. So still trying to make the same changes to the immune system that the peanut flour may have, but not ever having to go through the mouth where they may be, you know, concerned for taste or texture or anything else like that. At this point in the studies we've seen, there's been some benefit there, but after 1 year treatment, it's unclear sort of how much protection people are getting from there. So it's going to be important to continue to see where this research goes and whether additional years of treatment can continue to push how much protection that people get. And then I also think what's really, really important is going to be to find a way that we can predict who those ones are that are going to do well for it. But again, I think the convenience factor of the patch, as well as what the early signs of it being a very, very safe treatment, are going to be really, really attractive to people. And so just, again, finding ways to further improve the benefit from it and then to prove it as well are going to be essential.
Well, Edwin Kim, as a researcher, you, as you've said, collaborate with some of the people who are developing these therapies, and you also consult with some of the companies that are working on them. And then you yourself are working on developing yet another potential therapy. And these are peanut drops that are actually placed under the tongue. Where is that work in its development stage, and how effective does that look as an option?
Yeah, we're very, very excited about this. So the treatment is called sublingual immunotherapy. So again, the idea is rather than in a sticker form and rather than eating the food into your stomach, this is actually peanut extract that is held under the tongue and absorbed there, and that's how it gets to the immune system. And it seems to be, by being able to directly access the immune system there, we're able to get away with using a lot smaller dose than perhaps if you had to eat it. Mm. And from that, it seems to have a better safety signal. We have kids who complain of some itching in the mouth after the treatment, but it goes away on its own within, say, 10 to 15 minutes and really doesn't progress into anything more severe than that. As far as the amount of protection, from what we've seen there, kids are getting anywhere from 10 to 15 to even 20 times the amount of peanut that it might take to have an accidental ingestion or reaction in a restaurant or something else like that. So it doesn't seem to have quite the massive amount of protection that the peanut flour may have, but still seems to be more than enough to protect against some of those, again, uncontrolled exposures that may happen out there in the wild. And then again, not quite as easy to do as putting a sticker on the pack, but a few drops under the tongue held for a couple minutes and then, you know, on with your day, it's not too bad either. So if you really see it as sort of finding its kind of self in the middle, a balance of convenience and safety as well as efficacy.
Are these therapies available to patients now, or are they still in the laboratory or clinical trial phase?
Unfortunately, all three of the treatments that I mentioned are still in the research phase. The peanut flour, of course, has just recently gone through an advisory committee from the FDA and is sort of in their arena right now. You know, I think everyone in the food allergy world is hoping for a positive decision there, but we'll have to wait and see. The peanut patch is also sitting at the FDA as well. And so, again, we're equally optimistic there because I do think it's vitally important for patients to be able to have choice. And then the sublingual that we're doing right now, unfortunately, still it's a step behind when it comes to sort of development. So we've shown over a couple of our own internal studies, as well as a couple of other larger studies that have been done, that it can be effective. But really, we need to be able to sort of take it to that next level and have that larger study across multiple centers, maybe even across multiple countries, to be able to show that this is not sort of a fluke that we have found at a single center, but yes, this really does have the potential that these smaller studies show And then that would be really exciting, where patients could have multiple options depending on sort of their stage of life or their lifestyles about what might make the most sense for their child.
Given how much advice about when and how to introduce potentially allergenic foods to kids has changed and how much our understanding of these allergies has changed, what's the current state of advice to parents about peanuts?
Unfortunately, I think it's still been unclear. And we've had lots and lots of pregnant moms or moms who have delivered and are breastfeeding ask the question of exposure to them. So if they're eating while they're pregnant or if they're eating while they're breastfeeding, what does that do to my child? Does that potentially protect them because it's exposing them early, or does it set them up to become allergic? And unfortunately, at this point, I think the research is still not clear. We do have some of these larger cohorts, birth cohorts, that are happening actually across the globe, one of the best ones in Australia, trying to help us to understand a little bit more about what are the risk factors that are going to cause people to become allergic or, again, potentially protect them. But we're at a stage now where we don't have a great answer. And I know it's very, very frustrating for pregnant moms as well as just families alike. And so our advice is quite wimpy at this point, but it seems to be mostly in moderation at this point until we know better.
Edwin Kim is an assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics and director of the UNC Food Allergy Initiative at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. New York, London, Milan, Paris, the fall fashion weeks are over, the newest trends have been declared, and fashion-forward consumers are off to the mall. And the whole cycle will repeat in a few months with the winter, and then spring, and then summer fashion shows. The pace of change in clothing trends has picked up exponentially in recent years. The good news for style-conscious consumers on a budget is that high fashion has gotten a lot less expensive. The bad news is that fast fashion takes a huge toll on the environment. In fact, clothing manufacturing is one of the most polluting industries on the planet. Growing the cotton necessary to make just one t-shirt uses the same amount of water that a person drinks in 2.5 years. Cotton farming accounts for a quarter of all insecticides used globally, and dyeing and rinsing natural textiles accounts for a fifth of all water pollution globally. And then there's the fact that much of that clothing we buy ends up in the trash. In 2018, Americans buried 14 million tons of fabric in landfills. Nick Angelov is an associate professor in the Department of Public Policy at UMass Dartmouth and author of The Dirty Side of the Garment Industry, Fast Fashion and Its Negative Impact on Environment and Society. Nick, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Nick, you are a professor of economic development, but you actually started your career in the fashion industry, started a business, and you say that even with that insider knowledge, it is difficult to really get a handle on the environmental footprint of clothing. This is something I have heard from others who have tried to dig into this issue. Why? Why is it so hard to figure this issue out?
Because the production process is so complicated and globalized. There's so many links. And the innovators in fashion that have brought us the retail of mass market production that we know today is value retail, which is brands like The Gap and Esprit, brands that we know have many stores easily available to us that put a lot of product on the shelves, product that we all can afford. And then there's the other tier of producers and innovators in the fast fashion industry that are bringing us a much cheaper merchandise. So now there's innovation now with technology. Blockchain technology is something that is happening where a digital ID is being put onto the different components and the different stages of outsourcing and on-contracting. And eventually now the goal with certain innovators that are moving this technology into the fashion industry like Vice and Fazoid is to have a digital circular ID so that folks can trace from the cotton producers, whether they were using a better cotton, they were parts of the Better Cotton Initiative and using a more sustainably grown cotton or organic cotton, to the weavers of the yarn from that cotton and the processing plants that will actually turn it into yarn, to the fiber manufacturers, to the fabric manufacturers, to then the assembly plants to then the finishing and trimming plants that will actually put the whole garment together. And then we're talking about distribution, whether you're going to have a greener supply chain, whether you're going to fly it somewhere overnight or transport it in a better way, whether you're going to use technology to not have backlogs into your warehouses. So things are moving at a very rapid pace because the industry is so complicated.
Nick Angelov, when we think about the environmental footprint of that huge chain of events that leads to a single simple T-shirt, is it possible to highlight particular steps that create the largest environmental footprint? I mean, obviously, there are potentially very different environmental impacts at different steps of the way. But if we were to look at a T-shirt, is the biggest impact just the carbon footprint of all the different times that things are shipped around the world? Is it the water of growing the cotton? Is it chemicals used in dyeing and manufacturing? Is there any point that seems to have a bigger footprint than the other steps in the process?
The most troubling is the dyeing, the wet processing, dyeing being the culminating of all of them. They still use technology that was developed in the 50s and 60s. They use dyes that are extremely toxic. There's 72 identified toxic carcinogenic elements in the finishing of fabric, even before we're dyeing it, because we're using, into the sizing process, we're using chemicals to kill bacteria, then we're bleaching the fibers, then we're desizing them, we're removing alkali and starch from the process, then we move into the mercerizing, which is continuously dipping the yarn into a base bath and then an acid bath to neutralize it to make it porous. Then we put the plastic covering on them of the PETs, and then we get to the dyeing part. So these are very toxic processes that, of the 72 elements that are identified as carcinogenic that are used in those processes, 34 cannot be treated, period. There's no technology to purify them. So the innovation now is on the forefront to develop cleaner technology. There's even an academic journal called the Journal of Cleaner Production that really publishes a lot of lab-based, now it's still at the lab level, innovation where we can replace mercerizing and we can develop better pretreatment processes and we can develop new dyes like high fixation dyes so that they are not running off in the repeated dyeing processes. Because unfortunately, since we're talking about cotton, cotton is really dye resistant. You have to dye it several times. It just does not like to be dyed.
So, that's ironic, isn't it?
So it's very ironic. First, we got to bleach it so that we get it ready to dye it. And then we have to repeatedly dye it with the heavy metal dyes.
I want to go back to what you were saying about this new fabric and innovations in fabrics and just how difficult cotton is even to just dye. It's by far the most common fabric, but we have seen the rise of so many synthetic fabrics in recent years. And with that, we've seen concern that, oh my goodness, as you wash and dry these synthetic fabrics, they break off little tiny microscopic pieces of plastic that end up in the environment. Maybe synthetic fibers are not the way to go. But I wonder if you kind of look holistically at the whole life cycle and balance the water demands and the pollution inherent in dyeing cotton versus the, essentially plastic production and then potentially plastic pollution from synthetic fibers. Like, is there a better or worse there? Can you try to, it's an apples to oranges comparison, but is one better or worse than the other?
And at this point, sadly, polyester treatment recycling technology is further ahead than natural fiber recycling. At this point, we cannot recycle natural fibers. We can recycle polyester. So we're a little bit ahead in those technologies, particularly with chemical recycling and polyester. And these are complicated processes, but basically they stem back to the basics that polyester is kind of a plastic and you can melt plastic. We won't get rid of natural fibers, right? We just can't advocate as an industry to go straight into petrochemical products, right? I mean, that's like saying, let's just all wear plastic bags from now on, right? They're all going to be made from petroleum. We don't want to do that.
Nick Angelov, recycling, obviously, one part of the equation. But if we just go back to, the old reduce, reuse, recycle, a big part of the size of the environmental footprint of the fashion industry is just the size of the industry. How much is being made and bought and sold and in a lot of cases thrown away every single year? How much has that increased in, say, the past just 20 years?
It's quintupled. And those are conservative estimates.
So it's five times what it used to be.
Five times as much. So there's statistics that I've covered that says kids today are buying five times the amount of clothing that their parents did, than the previous generations did.
I'm going to go home and tell my kids that.
Right. So it's quintupled in a way that when I first started doing research on this, which was around 2010, 2012, was the first conference presentation. My book came out in 2015. The industry has been estimated around $1 trillion. Then it moved up to $1.5 trillion. The latest estimates from BBC were like up to $3 trillion.
What needs to happen on the consumer end of things?
Oh.
Is it a matter of smarter buying or just buying less?
It is a matter of that. The problem is that it's easier said than done. Can you start a conversation with your child about no more back to school shopping?
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? You know, kids are feeling right? A lot of peer pressure.
A lot of peer pressure. The average consumer that the industry now targets is 12 to 16 years old. When I was a fashion student, that was the mantra of my fashion education. Who's your average consumer? Female, 18 to 24. Who's the next largest consumer? Female, 24, 32. Those are my main demographics. These are the people that I had to worry about to sell them anything and everything from lipstick to accessories to clothing. In this day and age, the first thing that a fashion student learns is, who's your main consumer? Non-gender specific 12 to 16 year old. Boys are consuming just as much as girls. Back to school shopping is a big cultural component for us, right? On average, 2014, we were spending in 1 week of back to school shopping $600 per kid. And out of that $600, less than $200 was spent on real school supplies or non-clothes related items. So $400 per kid just in 1 week. When we're talking about fashion, we tend to think about adults. But then the industry really sells to kids. So we have to get the kids involved.
Nick Angelov is an associate professor in the Department of Public Policy at UMass Dartmouth and the author of The Dirty Side of the Garment Industry, Fast Fashion and Its Negative Impact on Environment and Society. Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Up next, what it really takes to think long term. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Climate Week has come and gone with its high-profile protests, ambitious announcements, and inspirational speeches. What we are left with is the enormous challenge we face if we are going to get climate change in check. Part of what makes climate change such a hard problem to tackle is that it requires long-term thinking, something that we as individuals and as society seem to find particularly difficult. But why? Is it an innately human quality or something we've built into our institutions? And most importantly, can we change that? Those are some of the questions Bina Venkatraman sent out to answer with her new book. She's the director of global policy initiatives at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, a lecturer in MIT's Department of Science, Technology, and Society, and she advised the Obama White House on climate change innovation. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Bina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you start the book with a very personal story that has nothing to do with climate change or other big societal problems, but about going for a hike and a subsequent health problem. And it's a story that illustrates our tendency toward short-term thinking, and I think it's a story a lot of people will relate to. So give us that story.
Sure. So a few years ago, I was hiking in the Hudson Valley in New York, just north of New York City, and I ended up the next day finding a rash on the back of my leg. It didn't look like the telltale bullseye you associate with a tick bite, but it turned out it was a tick bite. And I kind of ignored it because I didn't see that sign, even though it had swollen up and it was itchy and crimson. And it was only 8 months later, after ignoring it because I was working so hard and couldn't spare the time to go to the doctor, that my knee blew up and it was about the size of a grapefruit. And I had a really bad case of Lyme disease that took months to treat. It required me to go on IV antibiotics. And it was just an example to me of my own frailty, my own sort of neglect of warning signs, even clear warning signs. I knew that I was hiking in an area with a high prevalence of Lyme disease and ticks. I didn't even wear bug spray that day. But I think we're all kind of prone to this kind of thinking, which is to say that if you try to warn a teenage driver not to speed or tell someone, oh, don't date that guy because he's going to break your heart, right? We can see clear warning signs, but sometimes we can't exactly follow them. And that really extrapolates out to some of the biggest challenges we face as a society today. So if you think about climate change, for example, when I was working with companies from the White House, I was trying to persuade CEOs and corporate leaders to take action on a future of coming droughts and wildfires and floods. But so often I found that those executives told me that they'd like to do something, they cared about doing something, they cared about their children and grandchildren, but they just couldn't figure out how to plan ahead, whether it was because of how their boards and their shareholders evaluated them or just the day-to-day demands of their jobs. And that sort of set me off thinking, you know, is this really something that we have to accept as just innate in human nature? Or is there a way to question it? Is there a way to change that proclivity we have to focus on what's right in front of us and ignore the warning signs? What I actually found through researching the Optimist Telescope, my new book, is that there are a number of ways in which we can actually reclaim this ability to think ahead. We can change environments. We can change institutions. We can actually make better choices than we're making today. And that's, to me, a source of hope.
Obviously, being able to make a choice, yes, that's a good thing, but we don't seem often to make that choice. And I wonder if you see today, this age, as a more reckless age than others. I mean, people worrying about reckless human behavior goes all the way back to Aristotle.
Sure.
We've been talking about humans being reckless for a long time.
Absolutely. It goes back to Plato, Aristotle. You're absolutely right. This idea that our inability to see the future leads to folly. I think the difference with our generation is the scope of the challenges we face and the knowledge we have about the future. So I think we need to be better than our predecessors, actually. We're being called upon, I think, to be better ancestors than our ancestors were because of the challenges we face, because we're living longer than our grandparents. We have a longer lifespan to think about just from our own personal point of view. And because of the way we're changing the planet.
Bina Venkatraman, in the Optimist Telescope, you say, and you've said here, that people often want to make the right choice. Even when we do think long term, we say we want to act on behalf of the future. We want to leave a better planet and a better situation to our children and grandchildren, and then we don't actually do it. So what did you learn about why? What is the disconnect there?
Right. And a great example comes from doctors, for example, who are steeped in medical knowledge about the consequences of the decisions they make in their practice. And when I studied the way that doctors prescribe antibiotics in situations where a patient's really desperate for an antibiotic or the doctor is really tired with the backlog of patients, what you find is that the same doctors who say they know it's inappropriate to prescribe antibiotics in certain situations to people who have coughs and colds and who don't really need them because it's going to be cleared up another way or it's a virus, that they'll still do it in those situations. And a lot of it has to do with scarcity of time or mental bandwidth to think about those future consequences and what I would call failures of imagination, inability to bring the present and future into proper focus and into proper perspective. When it comes to the future, we don't have that kind of sensory input. We don't have the visceral reaction to it. So we have to conjure in our minds. It's a figment of our imaginations. And so what this tells us is that we need tools to better imagine those future consequences and that there are ways to gain those tools. For example, in the context of antibiotic prescribing, one of the things that's been found to work very successfully in the UK's health system, for example, is sending letters from high-profile British leaders to doctors and telling them when they're not prescribing at a very good rate, when they're prescribing inappropriately these antibiotics, and it changes the norms and sort of their expectations for their behavior. There's also ways to interrupt the moment of prescribing to help those doctors better imagine the future consequences, which are, by the way, superbugs that are growing to kill millions of people around the world. In the case of our individual lives and trying to make something like climate change more of a priority when we vote or when we think about our decisions or using our political power, it helps to do things like writing letters to the future, writing letters to someone 50 years from now, a child, a niece, a nephew, a godchild, yourself, and to take on the perspective of that imagined person in the future and try to put yourself in that place. So these are just some of the many tools that we need and can use that I write about in the book that help bridge that gap between what we think we know and our values, what we really want to be doing because we care, and what we actually end up doing.
Bina Venkatraman, in the Optimist Telescope, I really appreciated that it's not just an academic exploration of what has worked and what hasn't worked in the past, and there are lots of wonderful case studies. But there's also, at three different levels, pretty specific, like, how-tos. And you've already hit on some of these at the individual level, right? You could write letters to yourself. You could use VR to try to experience what a future with different choices might be like. But then you also take this on at higher societal levels, businesses and organizations, and then our communities and our whole society. What are some of the steps, perhaps, that individuals within their organizations or their communities could be taking right now to try to improve long-term thinking?
Sure. So one of the challenges in the business world is the way that value and progress are measured. So oftentimes we choose sort of metrics or targets that are reflections of the immediate term, like quarterly profits in a business, or let's say it's the number of meals served by a nonprofit. But those metrics are not always the true measures of what that organization is trying to achieve over the long term. And so one of the things that companies could do and investors could do, even people who are sort of individual investors, is to think about how to measure those, what you're doing, based on milestones instead of metrics. So looking at what are true reflections of value. Is something a real measure of whether a company is going to grow its market share or the loyalty of its customers, or is it merely noise in the immediate term? At the societal level and community level, a lot of what we need to do as individuals to affect those changes is to use our political power, hold our institutions accountable for looking at future issues, making those future issues a priority. But I have a lot to say to political leaders and others about how to better bring the future into focus. It includes things like using role play games instead of scenario planning so that you can take on some more of this imaginative empathy I was describing with the letter writing. It includes mending some of our institutional failures, including things like campaign finance reform, which often get in the way of leaders looking towards the long term.
When we think about organizations and a culture and a society that is, as a whole, better at long-term thinking, are there good examples that we can turn to? We certainly have examples of complete collapse of civilizations in the past because of failure for long-term thinking. Do we have good examples to turn to where long-term thinking has succeeded?
Well, I think uniformly across a society, you don't tend to see total long-term thinking. What I write about in the book is trying to create shared heirlooms. So in our families, many of us keep heirlooms or get heirlooms. And for me, I have a particular heirloom, and it's an object, it's an instrument from my great-grandfather, and it is of irreplaceable value. It's something that if someone stole it, there's no way any amount of money could replace it. Well, as a society, that's true as well. There are resources we have, clean air, clean water, our national parks, for example, where we can't replace them if they're destroyed with just investing in the stock market over that same time period. You couldn't replace the Mona Lisa if it were destroyed, right? It's an irreplaceable heirloom that belongs to all of us. And so for these kinds of resources, I recommend that societies do try to treat them like shared heirlooms. And the national parks are an example of how you can do that. You create institutions, funding, norms, ways to protect them, and then each generation uses them so that those heirlooms become part of the cultural identity of a society. So I think more than we see whole societies that are oriented toward the long term, we see great examples of acting like ancestors and descendants that need to become more prominent and more part of how we think about our own society and its future.
That's Bina Venkatraman. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.